Today's episode of The Grave Talks is brought to you by Best Fiends. Engage your brain with fun puzzles and collect tons of cute characters, too. Download free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. It's Best Fiends. That's friends without the R. Best Fiends. Today on The Grave Talks, growing up in a haunted house. Growing up in a haunted house, John Olson's initial experiences with the paranormal were vast. When you have unexplained noises, sights, feelings invading your life on a regular basis, it's easy to accept the paranormal simply as a part of life. As John grew older, his understanding and quest to learn about ghosts grew deeper. This led him to investigate not only the hauntings that dotted his life, but also the experiences of others who led a haunted life. Growing up in a haunted house turned out to be a more common experience than most would imagine. Today on The Grave Talks, we hear the personal haunted story of John Olson.
So I grew up in this home that was over 100 years old. It was built roughly in the 1880s. It was originally built by the railroad back in the day here in Utah. The railroad would pay or get paid from the government using land grants. And then they would take that land and usually either have it developed and sell or something like that in order to make the money to build the railroad. And this land that I grew up on was part of that here in northern Utah. And they had built the house and then sold it. And it became an old farmhouse. And it stayed in my family on my father's side from about the second owner, which was close to the turn of the century, the 1900s. And my parents had bought it. It had been abandoned for about 5 years. So they had to come in and do a lot of cleaning and start renovating it. And that was in the 60s. And then me and my sister and my brother came along in the mid-70s, and as I grew up in the 80s, got to be about 8 years old, I realized that the house that I lived in was considerably different than my friends' houses. I remember the very first thing that we noticed, my sister and I, was what we termed the stair monster. And the reason we called it that was at any time during the day, there was a steep set of stairs that went from the main level up to the second level where my sister and I, my bedroom and my brother's bedroom was. And in fact, if you built that today, it was no way it would pass code because it was so steep. And it ran over the one bathroom that we did have. And at any point of the day, you could hear heavy footsteps going up and down or fast children's footsteps going up and down. And of course you'd run around and look and there wouldn't be anybody there. So we started calling it the stair monster because that was the first thing that we kind of connected. It wasn't long before we started having other experiences in the house. And, my parents at the time, growing up in a small town, were really afraid of us sharing our experiences outside of the home. They were afraid people were going to think we were weird because we had a ghost in our house. And so we told each other the stories and we shared it inside the home, but we didn't really share it outside of the home. And I remember one story that stands out to me. I was in eighth grade. And I just got home from school and nobody was home yet. My mother was out running errands and I made myself a sandwich and went into the living room, sat down on the couch and was going to get ready to turn on the television. And something caught my attention at the corner of the room at the doorway. And I looked and here was an extremely tall man in a white shirt and overalls and a wide-brimmed hat, and he was mostly see-through. I couldn't make out any facial features. And he walked into the room, and across from the couch I was sitting on was a rocking chair. And he sat in the rocking chair and started rocking back and forth. And I remember closing my eyes and counting to 10 and opening my eyes again. And He was gone, but the rocking chair continued to rock for a minute and then stop. And I jumped up and went to the front porch and sat until my mother got home, because I didn't want to be in the house alone. But there were so many things like that that went on. We would have things go missing and then reappear several days later. One of the example of that, I remember my brother and I were in the basement. It was a Saturday morning, and me and my brother and my dad were the only ones home. And my dad, back in the day when you had to order, if you wanted something special, you had to order out of a catalog. He had ordered some new hunting boots, and they had shown up, and he was excited about putting them together. And he got the boots out and set them on the table, and got the laces out and set them on the table next to the boots, and then turned around to get scissors to cut all of the packaging off. And when he turned around, the boots were there, but the boot straps were gone. The shoelaces were completely gone. And I remember my brother and I were in the basement, and he yelled at us down the stairs to bring back his shoelaces. And we looked at each other, and we said, "We haven't left the basement. What are you talking about?" And he looked all over the house for about a half an hour and could not find those shoelaces, under the table, over. And so he finally gave up on it and went out to the front porch to start doing some chores. And sure enough, laying on the table outside of the house was the shoelaces, unwrapped and lying over the picnic table that we had just outside of the door. And again, me and my brother had never left the basement. Nobody else was in the house. And it was around that time we realized that it was really rather a trickster ghost. It really enjoyed playing tricks on people. And it never felt malicious, but it definitely had an edge to it where it enjoyed to play pranks on people. And in particular, it liked to pick people that either was more afraid of it, or that at first denied it, which was part of my dad. My dad denied that there was anything in the home at all. And then he had to finally start relenting and say, yeah, there's definitely something here that is abnormal. But as I got older and I had friends over at the house as a teenager, I remember a story. I was upstairs with a friend of mine, and we were studying biology, and I was reading my book. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, she picks up her book and she slams it down on the little coffee table. And she looks at me, and I said, what's going on? What's the matter? And she says, what is that? And I looked at her and I'm like, what is what? And she says, we've been up here for about 30 minutes. And in that time, three times somebody has run up your stairs here or back down the stairs, and there's nobody on your stairs. What's going on? And I said, and I finally had to break down and say, oh, I said, well, my house is haunted. And I told her some of the stories. And from there, I suddenly became the guy at all the parties that had the ghost stories, and people wanted to hear about my house and my experiences. And after I started doing that, I had more and more people coming to me and bringing me their stories. But by the time I was 17, I was interviewing people and collecting their stories and jotting them down, knowing that one day I wanted to write at least one book, if not more, talking about their stories and my experiences.
So it really kind of made you socially the guy that it's safe to talk to about these things, because other people you go and share these stories to, they're going to think you're crazy. But they knew that this was already a reality for you. So did you have a lot of friends that would come to you with their own stories that were not going to share it with anybody else?
Oh, yeah. Yes. It would be interesting, because I would be at a party, and there would be a whole room of people, and I would share my experiences, and some people would laugh and some people would be interested. But inevitably, it would be a day or two later that one of my friends or somebody who was at the party would come to me on their own and say, I had this experience happen to me. And they always started, it's amazing how many of them start with, I'm not crazy, I promise, but I've had this experience and I want to share it with you, because they did. They felt safe because of my background and because of what I had experienced. And because I was able to share it, they felt very comfortable sharing their experiences with me.
Let's go back to, you had mentioned your dad at some point finally had to be like, okay, there's something going on here, because I know you guys, you kids aren't the ones responsible for all the mischievous things going on around here. How were your parents handling that as things continued to escalate and as more things started to happen? What was the progression there? Was it immediate acceptance that, okay, there's something ghostly going on here, or how did that go?
Well, my mother was very much more open to it than my dad. I think my dad was a little bit more traditional, and his fear was more along that people would think we were crazy. But, for example, I remember I came home one day, and at the time there was only one bathroom in the house, and it had an opening to the front area and then also to my parents' bedroom. And I came home and all of a sudden the door is off on my parents' side of the bathroom and my dad is walling it up. He's preparing to wall it up. And I thought that was extremely strange. And I asked, why are you walling that part up? And my dad wouldn't give me a straight answer. But it wasn't until years later that my mother explained to me that she would wake up in the middle of the night, and no matter if they shut the door or what they did, she would wake up in the middle of the night, and this gentleman with the wide-brimmed hat would be standing in the doorway staring at them from the bathroom. And they finally got so sick of that their final solution was to wall up that door so there was only one entrance to the bathroom. And it wasn't until we were older that my parents started opening up and saying, yeah, these are the experiences that we had. And their reasoning was they didn't want us to be any more afraid than we were. But honestly, growing up in that, I was not afraid. By the time I was, 10, 11 years old, though some things did happen, like seeing that full body apparition was frightening. For the most part, when it happened, it was more a peculiarity or almost for me an excitement, because I got so excited in the paranormal. I read every book I could. I did everything that I could to explore it, because at the time I wasn't allowed to share my stories. But it definitely happened to everybody in the house. My parents just took longer to be able to open up to us kids and share their stories with us.
Did you ever, I mean, obviously, you know what the house was, that it was involved with the railroad. It was a railroad house. Mm-hmm. But were you able to get any more information about the former residents there or what had gone on in the house prior to it being abandoned and your family taking it over?
The one thing that I was able to find, other than the records of who owned it, I was able to find that. And interestingly enough, my grandparents lived just a block away. My family on my dad's side goes all the way back to the original pioneers that came across the plains and settled northern Utah. And when my grandmother passed away, we were cleaning out her house and everything, and we found quite a few old photo albums. And I remember looking through one of the photo albums, and I turned the page and I almost fell over, because there was a picture of my house, an old picture of my house, with a man with a white shirt and overalls, tall, skinny, with a wide brim hat. And I about fell over, because that was the gentleman that's haunting the house. And come to find out, it was a great, great uncle who owned it during the early 19th century, 1900s, and who had passed away there. They had raised a family there, and he had passed away there. And So I kind of got a good connection that way of that's at least one of the spirits that's there. But other than that, it's hard to tell. There has been one other apparition, which is a shorter gentleman with a beard, but we haven't been able to actually connect who he's connected to or how he is connected to the house.
All right, back to the interview in just a moment. First, our supporter today, want to thank them, the app Best Fiends. As you know, ghost stories, this sort of stuff, it's my passion, but every once in a while you need a break. You know, you just need a kind of escape. So when I feel like I need a little bit of a mental palate cleanser, my go-to app is the game Best Fiends. What I love about this is you don't have to be a hardcore gamer to get into it. Yeah, you don't have to like know tons of knowledge beforehand to play it. It's challenging, it's fun, but it's casual. So anyone can play at any time. It really is. I love the phrase palate cleanser because it kind of is like that for your brain. It's really fun. I'm on about level 34 now. I just kind of play it when I just kind of want to take a break. And it could be when I'm sitting here at the desk or just when I'm, you know, in line at the store or something. It's there. Check it out for yourself. Really fun game. Beautiful on your screen. If you have, you know, a really, you know, a smartphone, you know, it's always kind of fun to see, like, push the limits of what it can do in terms of visualizations. But it's cool. You got to check it out for yourself. It is a 5-star rated game, which means a lot of people love this thing. You should check it out for yourself to see exactly what I am talking about. Best Fiends updates the game monthly with new levels and events. Never gets old. If you find yourself playing this thing at weird places and times, you're like me. It's okay. It has that effect. You just, you know, you get into it. Engage your brain with fun puzzles. Collect tons of cute characters too. 5-star rated mobile puzzle game with over 100 million downloads globally. Download free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's Friends without the R, Best Fiends. What sort of experiences did you learn about from your parents as you became an adult, or at least a late teen as you got older, and they didn't have to hide behind the "I don't want to scare my little kids" argument, where they were more open to sharing their experiences? Were there any experiences you learned about that were going on, that were happening simultaneously while you were a child, that you did not learn about till an adult?
Yeah, my mother shared several experiences. Her biggest thing that would happen quite often, she would be in the bedroom or another room making the bed or folding laundry, and she would see somebody walk in into the room and stand there, and she would assume it was either me or my dad or somebody, and she would start talking to him. Usually she assumed it was my dad because it was her room that it happened quite a bit, and she would ask a question and they wouldn't answer, and she would turn just to catch a glimpse of them disappearing, again being either the man with the tall man with the wide-brimmed hat or the shorter gentleman. She said that happened to her quite a bit. Some of the other experiences, it's interesting. My parents still own the home and they're still having experiences to this day in the house. And in fact, my children, as they've grown up, they've spent a lot of time at grandma and grandpa's house because I lived one town away while most of my children have been growing up. And some of the experiences they've had, in particular, my oldest son, Cody, for some reason, the ghost is really taken, I don't know if you would say taking a liking to or enjoys teasing, or one story that pops out about Cody. About 10 years ago, my mother, who loves Christmas, had purchased a snowman, and the snowman stood about 4 feet tall, and it was all cloth, and it had a base that was a heavy sandbag base so that you could set it out and it wouldn't move, supposedly. Well, the ghost would like to move that when it was Christmas time, and it was up in the main family room. We would come home and it would be moved all over. My parents would tell me it would be moved all over. And my oldest son mentioned several times out loud that he didn't like that snowman. Well, when he was 15, so this would have been about 5 years ago, my dad paid him to come and paint the hallway in the basement. And in the basement, there's only one entrance, one exit. There's a hallway you go down. Now my parents just use it as storage. So they had the snowman down there with some of the other decorations. And my son had his headphones on and was painting the hallway. And he got a kind of a really creepy feeling. And he stuck his head around into the room, and the snowman was turned around and facing him. And he doesn't, like I said, he never liked the snowman for whatever reason. So he goes in and he muscles the snowman around and puts it in the corner, almost like you would put a child in timeout. And he goes back to painting and puts his headphones back on. And it goes about 10, 15 minutes, and he just gets a really creepy cold feeling. And he takes his headphones off, and he pokes his head around the corner into the basement. And not only had the snowman turned around, but it was about halfway across the room towards him. And he put down the paint, and he turned around and walked upstairs and told Grandpa that he wasn't going to do any more painting until the snowman was out of the house. So my dad had to go down, and he wrestled the snowman out onto the porch, where it sat for about 3 years until my parents sold it at a garage sale. I asked my mom, I said, did you tell him it was a haunted snowman? And she said, no, it's not haunted. It's the house that's haunted. So hopefully nobody took a haunted snowman home from a garage sale at some point.
Your parents still living there? I'm assuming. I mean, obviously they've been there for quite some time now. Are they pretty much at peace with what's going on there? Has there ever been a time where it's ramped up to the point where they've just almost said, you know, we got to move on from this. We'd like our peace away from this thing.
You know, I've had many people ask me, you know, why didn't you, have you ever thought of having the house cleaned, you know, cleansed and or whatever to get rid of it? And even to today, the way it's always gone, interestingly enough, is it'll be quiet for months and months, and then there'll be a couple months of just really kind of a lot of activity. And so my parents, it doesn't really bother them. And it's never really bothered any of us, except for when we were really small children. So I think, and since I've started writing the books, my parents, it's funny, my dad will call me really excited when something has happened to him, and he'll share the story with me. And so I just don't think that they're really bothered by it that much. Oddly enough, it seems to ramp up a lot when my parents have gone on vacation and one of us kids have volunteered to house sit for them. One story that comes to mind, not very long ago, a couple years ago, my parents were on vacation and they asked me to house sit. And so me and my youngest son, who was about 10 at the time, we spent the weekend there. And because my mother has a little Shih Tzu dog, his name is Bassa, and they mostly want the dog taken care of and they're outside cats. And so we spent the night and watched TV till about 11, and my son fell asleep and I carried him upstairs to bed. And then I came down and Bassa was asleep in the kitchen in his little bed. And Bassa usually sleeps with my parents or he'll sleep with whoever's staying there. He likes to stay in the bed. So I asked Bassa if he wanted to go to bed, and he just kind of lifted one eye and then rolled over and went back to sleep. So I said, well, I'll just leave Bassa in the kitchen. And I went upstairs to bed and fell asleep. And 2 o'clock in the morning, I woke up to just a horrible racket going on downstairs. And I got out of bed and I walked down the steep stairs. And as my foot hit the bottom step, all of the banging and racket stopped. And Bassa was barking, and he barked a couple times and then whimpered. And I walked into the kitchen and I turned on the light, and I realized what the sound was. Every cupboard and kitchen drawer in the kitchen was open at a different level. And what it was every one of those was going and banging in the kitchen. And poor Bassa was just shaking under the table. So I checked the doors just to make sure, even though I knew nobody was in the house, and shut all the doors and picked up Bassa and went back to bed with him. But for some reason, when my parents are on vacation and we're there checking on the house, it seems to ramp up the activity a little bit.
So you have a great background here in paranormal activity that's very personal because it happened at your home. And you had said when you were in your teens, you were thinking, you know, someday maybe I'll write a book about this. Just not only of your own personal experiences, but the experiences that people were bringing to you. Let's talk about some of those experiences that have been brought to you in an interview, specifically the one where a woman came to you and she and some friends said they encountered a ghost and an oil lamp in the West Desert near an old railroad camp in western Utah. Can you talk about that?
You bet. Yeah, that's one of my favorite ones. So a friend of mine came to me and she said, you know, one of my friends that I met at the university, she has a great ghost story that you've got to hear. And so it was through her that I was able to meet this person. Her name was Jennifer and her husband's name was John. They had met at Utah State University and their love of the outdoors had brought them together. They loved camping. And they had stayed in the valley after they had both graduated and they were going to find jobs and they were spending the night. They decided one of the places that they hadn't stayed was in the West Desert, which is about 40 miles to the west of Cache Valley. And out there, there's a place called Golden Spike, which is where the Union Pacific Railroad met the Union and the Central Pacific Railroad met out there. And they have a big museum with two big engines and they kind of went by there and they checked that out and looked at it and read the history. And then they went out further along the railroad tracks out there and they found a place out there near the old railroad tracks to put up camp. And they had their friends with them that night, Amy and Brian, which was another couple that they liked to go camping with. And they had spent the evening, put up their tents and had dinner and were having a good time. And somebody made the suggestion of going for a hike. And in the West Desert, it's interesting because you can get, you think it's just sagebrush and rolling hills, which it is, but it's so easy to get disoriented. So they decided they were just going to walk along the railroad tracks for a little while. And so they started walking along the railroad tracks towards the west and visiting and talking. And she said it was peaceful the night. They could hear the coyotes yelping on the hill and they were talking and being quiet. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, they heard a train whistle blow, which kind of way off to the west, it kind of took them by surprise because there's not any trains out there at this time. And it sounded like an old-fashioned train whistle. And they were stopped listening to see if they could hear it again. And her husband, John, looked up and said, what's that? And they could see down the track, they could see a light. And they watched it in silence for a while. And it was kind of a yellow light bobbing and weaving. And it appeared to be coming closer. And so they sat and watched it, and then somebody noticed that the coyotes had stopped yelping and the entire night had gone super quiet. And she said at that point they started getting a really creepy feeling about what was going on. Something didn't seem right. As it got closer, they could see as it was bobbing and weaving and moving that it was an old oil lantern with a light. And as it got closer, they realized that there wasn't anybody with the light. It was just moving on its own and coming directly down the tracks. So they got really frightened. They stepped off the tracks down a little ways off the tracks to watch. And she said it was really interesting to see this lantern. It was shaking back and forth like somebody was holding it up high, but there was nobody holding the lantern. And as it got closer, they started to hear voices. But as it got closer and closer, they realized that the voices weren't English. And she recognized the language. It was Chinese. It was an Asian Chinese language she heard. And because she worked at Utah State and had gone to Utah State and had friends that were Chinese, there's quite a few Chinese students up there. She recognized the language, but obviously didn't know what they were saying. It was two gentlemen that were obviously talking, and the lantern came by, and the voices were really loud as they came by this group of people. And she said she'd noticed at this point they had all four huddled together because they were so frightened. And the lantern continued on past them and down the tracks, and it got down further and further, and then the light went out. And at that point, they heard the train whistle again, but coming from the other direction. It had almost gone along with the light. And they stood there in the dark for quite a while, and then the coyotes started yelping again. And then they started talking about their experience, and sure enough, they'd all seen the exact same thing. They'd heard the same thing. And the girls were a little nervous and wanted to go home, but the husbands had talked to them and talked them into spending the night staying. And they did, and they didn't have any other experiences, but she said for being her only paranormal experience, it was very vivid, and looking back on it, it was very exciting, but at the time, it was very frightening.
I can imagine. I mean, just having that experience and everyone simultaneously having it. I guess those are some husbands that should get an award for being convincing enough to keep people in a location. Or maybe it's not an award. I don't know. I mean, or I don't know.
Right. I don't know if I at that point would have stayed. But
I don't know if it's like if it's they convinced them or controlled them at that point. Because that's I don't know that there'd be any convincing for most to stay in an environment like that. My gosh. That's like kind of the stuff that horror movies are sometimes made of.
It really is. It's amazing like that. There's people, even, you know, ghost hunters that go out looking for it who don't have experiences that clear. So mm-hmm. Yeah, it would be very, very frightening.
Yeah. Let's talk about another story that I know you have of the lost Pioneer Boy.
Mm-hmm. So this story I got from a gentleman here in northern Utah when I was growing up. One draw to Cache Valley and the area is that you, no matter where you are in the valley, you're 10 minutes from the wilderness where you can hike and fish and hunt. And so because of that, growing up, a lot of the people that I talked to, their experiences were in the wilderness. And this was from somebody who actually was a friend of mine whose uncle. He said, "My uncle's got a great story. You've got to hear it." And I was eventually able to track him down to talk about it. And he told me the story of when he was 16. This was in the 70s. He had spent his life hunting. And when he turned 16, he was finally old enough to carry his own rifle. And his older brother, who was 19 at the time, decided that he would go with him and they would go hunting. And they spent the entire day hunting in the Cache National Forest. And they ended up near the evening time at a place, it's called Scare Canyon, which should be red flags all over right there when it's called Scare Canyon. And I have been to that area too. And it is kind of a creepy place, but they spent the evening at the top of this canyon called Scare Canyon. It's a big long canyon that actually ends in a bowl at the bottom. So oddly enough, my grandfather told me if I ever hunt there to take a knife and fork with me, because it would be easier to eat the deer at the bottom than try and drag it up out of it. But they sat at the top of the hill and were looking for deer, and the sun was going down and it was starting to get dark. It was almost past when shooting light. And his brother nudged him as they were sitting there quietly, and they could hear crying coming from the trees down towards their left, trees in the brush area down towards their left. And they listened for a minute, and sure enough, it sounded like a child that was sobbing and crying. And it really kind of took them by surprise because they hadn't seen anybody since noon, let alone anybody with children. So his brother hops up and starts heading down in towards the trees, and he's following his brother, and they're weaving their way through the brush and through the trees. And it takes them a little while to get down there, And they come to a little clearing, and his little brother, or his big brother, goes through. He's following him. And they step into this little clearing, and here's a child of about 9-10 years old. And he's sitting in just off the path, and he's on the ground with his knees drawn up to his chest, and he's got his head down on his knees, and he's just crying. And he said the first thing he noticed was that this little boy had an old style shirt on. It was dirty. He had really dirty, ragged overalls, that he was barefooted, and his feet were filthy dirty. And his older brother said, called out to the little boy and said, "Are you okay?" And this little boy looked up at him. He said his hair was all matted and kind of down near his face. His face was filthy dirty with tear tracks running down his face where it had cleared off. He said it was very vivid. And the little boy just pointed towards his left and their right, towards the trees. And so they both looked in that direction, and they couldn't see anything. And as they looked back to ask the boy what was going on, the boy disappeared right in front of their eyes. And he was in shock. He said he was in complete shock. It wasn't like the boy was see-through to begin with. He looked very solid, very, there. And then suddenly he vanished before their eyes, almost as if in a puff. And he didn't know how long he stood there staring at that spot when his brother finally punched him in the shoulder and took off through the trees back up. And he took off after his brother. And by the time they got up and out of the trees, it was almost dark. And they got to the car, hiked out to the car. And he kept asking his brother, trying to ask his brother what he saw, what was going on. And his brother refused to talk about it. And the only thing his brother said by the time they had gotten home was, "Don't tell anybody about that. Just let it go." And he had for many years. And many years later, he finally cornered his older brother and asked him. And his older brother remembered it exactly as he had remembered it. And he also had not had a lot of experience whatsoever with the paranormal and really hadn't thought about it much until his experience. But he was not sure what this spirit was, who it had been, what the little boy was pointing at, but he said it was extremely creepy, and really, it gave him nightmares for quite a while, he said, when he was a teenager.
That wraps up part one of our interview with John Olson. In part two of our interview, a haunted college campus. It's more common than you may think. John talks to us about the dark history of Old Maine. Also, what were some of the most disturbing haunting experiences that John has ever encountered? Is there a ghost train that haunts a long abandoned rail line? And what is the strange, horrid creature that some encountered in a forest late at night? That and more in part two. To hear it, become a gravekeeper. Sign up on our website, patreon.com/thegravetalks. $5 a month gets you access to all of our bonus material, as well as advanced episodes released to you, the Gravekeepers, months before they go to the public. Sign up, patreon.com/thegravetalks. For more information on John's stories, visit his website at strangerbridgerland.com. Until next time for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.